Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about how I got involved with representing. I only have one client. Candace had three. And I'm going to talk a little about how I got involved and how people like my client got to Guantanamo. And then Candace is going to talk more about what's going on right now. Guantanamo, as most of you know, was set up really as an interrogation camp. When we invaded Afghanistan after 9/11, the theory was that we were going to go in there and there was going to be all these terrorists, high-level Al-Qaeda terrorists, that we would capture, and then we wanted a place to send them to interrogate them and find out everything they knew about plots against America. This was the theory that was cooked up by the Bush administration. The camp was located in Cuba because they believed that would be outside of territorial U.S. jurisdiction, and that the people there the courts would have no jurisdiction over any of the inmates at Guantanamo. The design of the camp was based on some theories, really some very bizarre theories about depriving people of all human comfort and making them completely dependent on their captors, and in that way they would want to give information. So anything the prisoners wanted, sunlight, news from home, they had to cooperate with their captors in order to get that privilege. Until one thing that Obama has done is the conditions, at least according to my client, have changed. They're a little bit better. He now has some socializing with other people. He's not locked in a cell 22 hours a day as he was before. As a matter of tactics, any experienced interrogator will tell you that these types of tactics are not good tactics to get reliable information. They're good tactics to get people to give confessions and to say what you want them to say, but they're not good tactics to get reliable information. But the most basic problem was the way they selected people to send to Guantanamo, and that is that, you know, there was some belief that when we got to Afghanistan, there would be all these people there that would, I don't know if they thought they were going to have T-shirts that said Al-Qaeda, but when they got there, they realized that it wasn't that easy to tell who the major terrorists are. And a lot of them weren't in Afghanistan at that point anyway. But they relied a lot heavily on the CIA. And the CIA in Afghanistan are in these armed camps. They don't know the culture. They don't speak the language. They would invite informants in, paid informants, to come in and tell them stories. And that's how they decided, in many cases, who to capture and who to send to Guantanamo. One of the things that they did, and this is sort of the American way of capturing bad guys, is you offer bounties. And they dropped flyers which offered cash rewards, you know, feed your family for a year, feed your village, turn in Al-Qaeda, turn in Taliban. You got more money if you turned in somebody that you could say was Al-Qaeda. You got a little less if you could just say they were a Taliban fighter. But that's how a lot of the people got turned in. I think it's something like 90% of the people that were sent to Guantanamo originally were not captured by the U.S. They were captured by Afghan warlords and sold to the U.S. Now, the files on the bounties have never been released. They're confidential, so we don't know who was sold and who was not sold. They've admitted that they paid bounties, but they won't say in any specific case that they paid a bounty. This is shocking to a lot of people who wonder why, in one of the poorest and most corrupt countries on earth, you would be paying people to turn people in. Like, how could you think that you would be getting reliable information? But this is what we did. My client's story is fairly typical. His name's Shawali Khan. He's sort of a country bumpkin. He grew up in the Argandab district outside of Kandahar. His family had a pomegranate farm. No formal education. In the year 2000, he moved to Kandahar because there was a drought on the farm. They couldn't make a living. He got a job as a shopkeeper in Kandahar. And he was captured in 2002 by men linked to a corrupt warlord named Sherzai, in Kandahar. And he was captured by Afghans. He was turned over to the U.S. We believe for a bounty, but they won't say. And his captors named him as a terrorist. And the file on him is, it's, in my view, it's quite shocking. I mean, it's, you know, it's these reports from unnamed informants from 2002, who say that they know he's a terrorist, that he was he was involved in bomb making, and he was plotting attacks on U.S. interests in Afghanistan. That's the allegation against him. Now, under the Geneva Convention, he would have had, I think it's called an Article 3 hearing, I'm not sure exactly what it is, but under the Geneva Conventions, before they could send him to some prison camp, he would have the right to what they call a battlefield hearing. And that's a very important thing, because for someone like my client, he could have had his neighbors come, he could have had his brother come, he could have had some witnesses that would say, no, he's a shopkeeper, this isn't true what you're saying about him. But once they send you to Guantanamo, you don't have those rights. You get a sort of a Mickey Mouse hearing, but you have no access to witnesses. You know, they put in a form, they fill out a form that says, I would like to have this person come. But I think in every single case, I think there was originally some 700 detainees there, I don't think they've ever produced, the U.S. government has ever produced one witness for a detainee. So they ask for a witness, but they're unavailable because, of course, they're, you know, many, many miles away from Cuba. They're not able to come to the hearings. So my client, he's been there for about 9 years. Let me just tell you a little bit about representing him. I began to represent him in 2007, so I came in a little bit late in the game. My first visit was November of 2008. Of course, you have to get your security clearance to go there, which, depending on what you did in high school, it takes, it's supposed to take like 6 months. It took me about a year to get my security clearance. Visiting your client at Guantanamo, I'm a criminal defense lawyer. I've visited clients in prisons all over, federal and state prisons, but nothing really prepares you for this. It's one of the most bleak places. I dread it. And and Candace is one of my heroes, because I'll tell you in a second what she's done, but I've made 4 visits there. Your client is shackled to the floor when you see him. Anything you want to show him has to be pre-screened. You can't give him anything, which is one of the most, you can give him food, but he has to eat it there. You can't give him anything to take back with him. And you can't give him books, which to me is one of the most frustrating things, because all my clients, I send them books from Amazon.com if they're locked up. This guy's been, you know, he was in a cell for 22 hours a day for 7 years. I can't give him a Sports Illustrated, something to look at, nothing. And that is, to me, really one of the most frustrating things. And maybe even worse than that is that there's so little we can do for our clients. I mean, at least with a criminal case, you can say, well, we have these rights, we can have a hearing, you know. With a Guantanamo detainee, really there's not much you can do for them. And this is, to me, this has been one of the most frustrating parts. I had 4 visits. So my first visit, I had filed in 2008. Was it 2008, 2007, the Boumediene decision? We finally got, the Supreme Court said we can file habeas petitions for our clients. So I filed the habeas petition. And then I got the visit in November of 2008 to tell him about this great petition I filed. Well, before I went to see him, the Red Cross had, the government had cleared him for transfer, which we've subsequently, well, first of all, I wasn't told about this, but they clear him for transfer and the Red Cross visits him and tells him you've been cleared for transfer. We subsequently learned that this is complete bullshit. I mean, they clear him for transfer, but they have no intention of sending him anywhere. It's a way of derailing his habeas petition. So. But when I go see him, he tells me, well, why would I want to do a habeas petition? I'm going home. They tell me I'm going home. So that was my first visit. My second visit, he finally agreed that he probably wasn't going anywhere, so maybe he would listen to me and cooperate with me on his habeas petition. So that was my second visit. My third visit, they had, the government had stayed the habeas petition for some, because they decided they wanted to do more searches for evidence in the CIA files on my client, and the judge granted that. By my third visit, I finally had a hearing date, and I discussed that with him, and he was excited about that. I told him it would be a real hearing in front of a real judge. He would get to testify. And then my fourth visit, they had stayed that hearing and postponed it indefinitely. So by my fourth visit, he fired me and told me he didn't want to see me again. Then we got another hearing date, and he finally decided to let me represent him. The case came to a hearing. I couldn't be in two places at once, so Candace agreed. He wanted to testify, so he has to have a lawyer with him to testify. So Candace agreed to make the trip to have him testify. Well, we had the hearing Thursday and a Friday. This was in October and November. Friday, anything he says from Guantanamo, even though he's a shopkeeper from Kandahar, they consider anything he says a security risk. So it has to go through a descrambler, or whatever you call it. So that equipment mysteriously broke down on Friday. So Candace was sitting with him all day, preparing him to testify. The equipment didn't work, so he wasn't allowed to testify. The judge said, well, we'll just postpone this for another date. I said, Judge, you know, my colleague, at great expense, has flown to Guantanamo. She's there with him. So they decided to postpone the hearing till Monday. Now, thank God Candace is such a good sport. She agreed to spend the weekend at Guantanamo, at the Guantanamo Beach Club. And the most important thing is the translator was available to stay. And
the most important thing?
Well, as good as Candace is, she does not speak, what language does he speak?
Pashto.
So anyway, the case was transferred to Monday. He did get to testify. He said, I'm a shopkeeper. I think there was a 2-second cross-examination of him. And we then learned in September that the judge has denied his habeas hearing. So the judge has found that it's more likely than not that he had some links to some group, and we're now appealing. So that's my story, and I'm going to turn it over to Candace.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
When the judge denies, does he have to cite something that has convinced him that your petition is denied?
He wrote an opinion. The opinion he wrote is classified, and I haven't seen it yet because I have to fly to D.C. to see his opinion. I've seen an unclassified version. Candace has actually seen the opinion, so she could probably answer that better than me.
It's not worth anything.
Yeah.
Or myself. When I was cleaning my office today, I found a little, one of those little notebooks that they sell in all the airports now, where people are all buying them because they're all aspiring journalists. Yeah, the Moleskins. Well, I've bought a number of Moleskins over the years, and sometimes I write in them for like 2 or 3 days, and then I lose them or put them away somewhere. And so I have a number of these sitting around. And I was looking for something, and I found this Moleskin. And I opened it up, and it was a Moleskin from 2006. And only 10 pages of it were used, because I obviously lost it at the time. And somehow I just found it today. But I want to share a couple of notes that were in there, because this was right after my first visits to Guantanamo. I started representing my first two clients. Actually, I had three clients, but one of them turned out to have another attorney. They had misspelled his name, and I got him, but he already had an attorney. So I ended up only representing two men. And one of them was freed this year, and I'll talk about him a little bit in a minute. And the other is still there, and he has a habeas hearing coming up, maybe in December. It was supposed to happen in October. Things happened. It got continued, and now it's supposed to happen in December. But here's what I found in my Moleskin. When the lie becomes the secret, how do we expose the lie? That was one page. Top secret lies become the problem of democracy. That was another page. And then the third page said only the third visit, November 2006. And just to give you a backtrack, as Len said, it takes a while to get your security clearance. It took Len a whole year. It took me 6 or 7 months, and that was because I called them all the time and said, you know, what's going on? But I didn't, even though I started representing my clients in 2005, I did not get to go to Guantanamo until July of 2006. And one of my clients, Mr. Al-Jazawi, who I wrote a lot about in these times, really wanted to see me and really wanted an attorney. And my other client, Razak Ali, it turns out that's not really his name, you know, he signed some form saying he wanted an attorney, but he never wrote to me, even though I wrote to him a few times. And when I went on my first visit, they told me it wasn't his name and I couldn't see him. And it ended up being quite a mess, and so I had to go in front of a judge and order, the judge actually, one of those rare moments, ordered the military to fly me down to see him because they screwed up my visit and I'm a sole practitioner. You know, those things don't happen anymore, but it happened once. I still haven't gotten the check, but I have the order. So anyway, the second visit I went down, something else got screwed up and I still couldn't see him. And so this was the third visit, and this was the third page of my little moleskin. When I left Guantanamo after my first visit, the emotion I left with was similar to the one I arrived with during this visit, anger. But in leaving at the end of this third visit, I've added a new emotion, grief, or for lack of a better word, sorrow. I still don't know the official or unofficial version or circumstances regarding Razak Ali. This is the client I had just seen for the first time. But I feel such grief at his detention. I know whatever BS the government says about this young man, that it is just that, BS. I then went on to note, and this is the end of my notes except for keeping track of the government spying on me, which took up the rest of the pages. But at the end, I made this little note that said, I assumed Al-Jazawi will be released very soon, but I think the battle for Razak Ali is going to take a while. This was in November 2006. Well, I was right on one of those parts, but I was wrong on the other. Al-Jazawi was not released very soon. He wasn't released until March of 2010. And that's even though our own government knew since 2004 that he was a mistake. But I couldn't find out even why Razak Ali was being held because of things that were going on in the courts and in Congress that stayed the cases. And when I say stayed, that's a legal term, but basically it means that everything stopped. And the judges were not hearing anything from the time I took on my clients' cases in 2005 until the end of 2008. And that's because first there was the question of whether or not they could even be in court. There was a Military Commissions Act and there was another Detainee Treatment Act that had to go through the court system. Then when the Supreme Court ruled a couple of times that these men do have a right to go to court, and then the new laws were passed. Every time a new law was passed, the cases were stayed again. And there was never enough time to even do anything or for a judge to, the judges that we had, to even give us information on our clients. So for Mr. Al-Jazawi, my first client, I actually got information about him from the judge in the fall of 2006, soon after I had visited him, because I told the judge my client was sick. And I not only did I know it from him, but I saw him, and I could tell he was sick. And the judge was probably sick of me by that time because I was already filing stuff repeatedly in court. And I think his rationale was, let her see this stuff and maybe she'll leave me alone, see what a bad guy he is. So he actually gave me the information on my client that the government had on him, which was a joke. That's how I found out that he was found not to be guilty the first time. I'm sure he was found not to be an enemy combatant. I'm sure the judge didn't know this when he gave me the okay to get this information. But the second judge never gave me any information about my client. And although I spoke with my client about why he was there, he's not a very well-educated man. He worked odd jobs. He's Algerian. He worked odd jobs. And although he never had a shop, but he's just kind of a young guy, although not quite as young as I thought. I thought he was like 24, 25, and it turned out he was closer to 30. But still a young guy in my mind's eye. But I still didn't know officially why he was there until the end of 2008. And I just knew that he was in a guest house. And he was in a guest house that someone who might be a bad guy was at. And that was the only thing that I could figure out from talking with him. The might be a bad guy is someone you might have heard his name, Abu Zubaydah. We waterboarded him 183 times. We put him in a coffin-shaped box and made him think he was being buried alive. We put him in closed spaces after they learned that he was afraid of bugs. They put him in closed spaces with bugs that they told him they were poisonous bugs. They tortured him. I'm not allowed to use that word in Razak Ali's courtroom. The judge has forbidden me from using that word. But they tortured Abu Zubaydah. And my client had the misfortune of going to a guest house in Pakistan and was there for 2 weeks when Abu Zubaydah arrived there. And 3 days later, the place was raided. Now, Abu Zubaydah was thought to be the number three man in Al-Qaeda. And the government has said, no one could be in this guest house unless they're connected with Al-Qaeda too. So therefore, all 25 people in this guest house are members of Al-Qaeda. Of course, I didn't know this until the end of 2008. By then, the government had already realized that they made a little mistake. Abu Zubaydah was not number three in Al-Qaeda. In fact, he wasn't connected with Al-Qaeda. And they've been backtracking in the case with Abu Zubaydah almost on a monthly basis. You know, first he was number three, then he was related, then he was affiliated. Now he has his own gang, the Abu Zubaydah force. And now my client is accused of being part of that force. Now Abu Zubaydah, who was tortured, was shown the pictures of all the people that were in the guest house and looked at my guy's picture and said, I think he might have been staying in that guest house, but I don't know who he is. Now, he did identify other people, but not my client, and not anybody else really in that house, except for maybe they were there, maybe they weren't. But that doesn't really matter to the government because their whole deck of cards is built on these 25 men being connected to Al-Qaeda because they were in this house. And then they have a different house where everybody was connected to somebody else, and they have this theory that these houses can only be used by people who are part of these, connected with these Al-Qaeda people, whether they are Al-Qaeda or not. But I knew from the very first time that I met Razak Ali that he was not, he loves Harry Potter. We sat the first time I visited with him, and I didn't want to be another interrogator. I just wanted to talk with him and get him to know me. And I said, do you get to read any books? Knowing that they get one book a week. And he said, yeah, I've read Harry Potter. And, you know, this was a few years ago when my kids were still young enough that they were reading Harry Potter. And it was still in the middle of the books coming out. So we sat there and talked with our interpreter, who had never read Harry Potter, talking about what happened in the book that he has not yet been able to read. And the interpreter was like, Dumbledore, is that a, is that an Arab name, or is that an English name, or, you know, and what's Osgoman? And, you know, so it was a very funny conversation, and it was, you know, it was very telling about my client, who is simple and kind, and who never should have been there, except that he had the misfortune to be in this guest house. So my client now will have a hearing, maybe, in December. And the government has now decided that even though Abu Zubaydah's house may not be an al-Qaeda house, it's an Abu Zubaydah house. And so now my latest chore is to show that Abu Zubaydah didn't have a force. He was not part of Star Wars or anything else. And one of the challenges that we have is not getting discovery. Discovery is also a legal term, but it's the information you get from the other side.
Where is this house?
It's in Pakistan. And that just reminds me of another issue. A lot of the people were not picked up in Afghanistan. A lot of them were picked up, well, 26 different countries is where we picked up the men at Guantanamo. A lot of them were in Afghanistan, maybe 100, maybe not quite 100. But most of them were picked up in random parts of the world. But he was in Pakistan. He was on a lark. I could tell you the story, and you might laugh, and you might just say, ay, ay, ay. But I'm sorry, I lost track of what I was going to say. He was in this house for only 14 days. And when I was getting ready for this hearing, I was going to talk about the discovery. We rely on the government for what we can show the judge. You know, the government doesn't like that. They don't like to give us stuff to help our cases. But they are forced to give us some things, but I think they've played pretty loose with the rules. And in Mr. Al-Jazawi's case, my first client's case, they accused him of being a bodyguard to Osama bin Laden. Now that one made me go, because I knew he was cleared for release. They found he wasn't an enemy combatant, and now all of a sudden he's declared to be a bodyguard for Osama bin Laden. And so I made some investigation, and I came to a conclusion that the person that made the accusation, who was another detainee, was crazy. Seemed like a logical conclusion, since this was obviously a ludicrous thing he was saying about my client. I also got some inside information to suggest maybe he did have mental health issues. And what I ended up doing was convincing the judge that I, on my own, was able to figure out enough to say that he was maybe mentally imbalanced. And the judge allowed me to get his medical records. And that's a coup in these Guantanamo cases, to actually get something that's going to help prove your case. And what I found was a stack this big of his medical files of all psychiatric records, including the fact that he had an alcohol dependency while he was at Guantanamo that didn't show up until many years after he was there. And he was accusing something in the order of 97 different detainees of different things, including, I think there were 20-some Osama bin Laden bodyguards. There were people who were would-be suicide bombers, people who were electronics. They were making electronic bombs. They were specialists in this. And he was doing this for perks, not the perks that Len was talking about, which is just getting health care or getting a clean sheet. But these were a little bit more special perks. And my client got cleared really quickly after I discovered this stuff. And I got it in front of the judge, because I just thought there's all these other people out there, even though the government all of a sudden decided my client was no risk and could be cleared for release. I knew that there were 97 other possible detainees out there. So I filed the medical records with the judge and gave them to everybody else within the confines of our secret facility where we can work. The other issue is, so it's really hard to get information, and you have to have a little bit of your own to get a judge to give you that extra inch. And a lot of the judges are not giving us anything. And my hearing that's coming up next month or in December, I have a similar problem. So now my client is Abu Zubaydah's part of his force. And even though he had only been in Pakistan for a couple of months and only in this guest house for a couple of weeks, I've got other detainees that have told the military that they've seen him in Afghanistan, they've seen him here, they've seen him there. One of the things that I discovered was that they were showing the wrong picture of my client. Well, you know, when you're saying, I saw this guy in Afghanistan, and you're saying that guy's my client, you better show the right picture. But this is the sort of the games that we have to deal with, and we've got to try to figure it out because the government's not giving us any help. And this hearing's going to be really interesting because there's a lot of information that the government has been not coming forward with that they're supposed to. There's a rule, even in these kangaroo proceedings, that they have to give information to us that helps clear our clients. It's called exculpatory evidence. They have to give us that. But those medical records for this guy that was accusing Mr. Al-Jazawi, even though it showed that he was, you know, crazy as a loon, were not considered exculpatory by the government. And what we're finding is that the government doesn't consider anything exculpatory unless it has maybe our client's name in it. That it says, you know, Joe Schmo admits now he made a mistake, you know, accusing Al-Jazawi. So they're playing loose and carefree with the evidence. You know, I have a million stories about Guantanamo and what's going on, and I could stay here for 3 days and not even tell you the whole story. But I think people have questions, and I would be happy to answer, and I'm sure Len would too.
How do you get paired with clients? Like, what's the process that detainees find a lawyer? And how do you select who you represent?
My process was I volunteered. And it actually took me a while. The first time I volunteered, I was not accepted. And then I volunteered again.
But who do you volunteer to?
I volunteered through a group called Center for Constitutional Rights, CCR, in New York. And they're one of the groups that has sort of spearheaded volunteer lawyers and matched them up. So I got matched up with a client. I didn't request an innocent client or a guilty client. I just requested a client, and I got matched up.
Is it pro bono work?
Yeah.
It's pro bono, and it's quite expensive, actually, because we have to pay our own way. We have to pay for our translators. A visit to Guantanamo is a minimum of 3 days of your time and the translator's time. Two travel days and then one visit day.
Unless you have two clients.
And then to do any work on the case, you have to fly to a secure facility, which we're not allowed to say where it is, but it's somewhere in Arlington, Virginia. And you have to go there and because they classify everything in the case. Like why it's classified, and this is one of my main gripes with Obama is, you know, why is he still following this? It's ridiculous because, you know, in my case, the file has, you know, reports from an informant who was interviewed in the winter of 2002, and he's unnamed, and everything's blocked out, and this is completely classified. So no reporter can write about the case, they can't look at the file. Obviously these informants are not still active informants for the government. There's no security reason to classify this. It's just to make it difficult for us as lawyers. We can't even talk to each other about our cases unless she files an appearance on my case. And we can't talk to the press about our cases. And we can't talk to In These Times. We have to be very careful in what we write on In These Times. In fact, I had an In These Times piece that I wrote. I brought it to I wrote it about my client. And when I went to Guantanamo, he wanted to see it. I said, you're famous, you're in the big time In These Times. And it was taken away from me by the guards at Guantanamo, so he didn't get to see the article. He wouldn't have understood it because it was in English, but, you know.
Might have felt a little better anyway. I was going to say, too, that there are a lot of empty glasses here. Some, a couple of you interns volunteered.
They're still like they were before 2008. We can't have anything. That's the simple answer. And I'll just tell you, the person who made the plea deal yesterday is the young man who was 15 years old when we brought him to Guantanamo. And under every treaty recognized by humanity, except for our country, and the Sudan, I think those are the two countries that never signed off on the treaty about children soldiers, he shouldn't have been there. He's been treated very badly. He's treated as a war criminal for possibly killing a soldier, which is just reprehensible. But more than that, there's actually evidence that he was so badly wounded in this firefight in the village where his parents, his father brought him to, that he probably couldn't have been engaged in any firefight. But he's been there for 9 years. And they made a plea deal because he would have been the first military commission trial by Obama. And I'm not very happy with Obama. And I think even his administration realized that this is kind of an embarrassment. For him first to backtrack and say military commissions are okay, and then to have to be the first one, a 15-year-old kid, who's being tried as a war criminal for possibly killing another soldier, killing a soldier in a battle. And so they did finally agree to a plea deal, which sucks. It just sucks. But this kid has an 8-year term, but 1 year is at Guantanamo, and the rest of his term is in Canada. And Canada, with their would-be Bush President Harper, or Prime Minister Harper, who has done nothing to get this kid out of there. Every other Western European country has gotten their men out of Guantanamo very early on, except for Canada, and then Australia was the last one before Canada, and that was a couple years ago. But Harper just refused to, you know, lift a finger for this kid, even though the Canadian Supreme Court said they had a constitutional duty to represent him, and that they violated his constitutional rights by not by helping with his interrogation. Canadians actually provided information. So this isn't really a movement showing that the government's moving forward. They're getting rid of an embarrassment. But they are still doing military commissions. They still believe that indefinite detention is the way to handle a number of these men. And of the 175 approximately that are still there, 100 of them have been cleared by the Obama administration since 2009. And there's been no movement getting them out of there. My one guy is lucky, Mr. Al-Jazawi. The country of Georgia, not the state, the state of Georgia freaked out when they heard that three Guantanamo detainees were going to be released to Georgia. They started actually trying to pass a bill to keep them out of there. But fortunately, it's the country of Georgia. Yes. You know, he was one of the last men to get out of Guantanamo, and that was in March. So, you know, things are not moving quickly. And my other client, the one whose only real charge against him is that he was in this house, is on the indefinite detention list. So Obama's got 100 cleared, but they're not going anywhere. And the other 75, about 45 of them are on the indefinite detention list, and then the other 30 are on the military commission or maybe federal court, because first they want to see if the federal court will bow down to them and agree that men that we've tortured and kept from not having a speedy trial for 7, 8, 9 years can still be tried and found guilty. So it's not a good situation.
Who are the judges? How are they chosen? And how would you characterize them as a group?
It's on film, right? Remember that.
I'm sorry?
This is on film.
Well, no, it's
Oh, okay.
Somebody else may have a camera.
We have to file in the district court in Washington, D.C. So we get the federal district court judges in Washington, D.C. Now, there's some theory that you could file these petitions in Chicago and in our federal courts, but the belief is that they would you would just be wasting time because they would get them removed to Washington, D.C. So we are, we're in front of the D.C. bench. And Candace could tell you more. I only know my one judge who hasn't been my friend, but.
Yeah, I know
well,
many.
Judges aren't supposed to be on one side or the other, right? But you make them sound as though they are on one side.
Well, I think there's a, I think like any federal bench, I think like any federal bench, there is a spectrum. Some of them are have been somewhat good, and some of them have been more kowtowing to the government and intimidated. So I don't know.
Yeah, and I would say most of them have kowtowed. There's a few good ones in the D.C. Circuit. I unfortunately have had the misfortune of having three different judges in one of my in Razak Ali's case. And my other case, I had the same judge that Len has, who I was not particularly happy with. But just to talk about the bias or the lack of bias or the supposed professionalism of the federal bench, my federal judge in Razak Ali's case, the second one, was the chief judge of the district court of D.C. He made a speech in December of 2009 in which he, to the ABA of all places, in which he stated, I don't know if I could ever let one of these men go from Guantanamo because who knows, they could be the one to blow up the Capitol. Well, that kind of got me mad because I thought, if he's saying this publicly, first, you know, what does this say about our judiciary? But what do I tell my client? You know, this is supposed to be a fair judge. So I filed a motion and asked him to recuse himself. Recusing yourself in a federal judge recusing themselves is a matter of their own discretion. There's really no, there are some rules, but it's really hard to get a judge to recuse themselves. But I didn't care if he did or not. I was mad, and I thought he should at least know someone's looking. And if you're going to say that stuff, this is what you have to expect. Well, amazing things happen. This judge was obviously not happy with my motion, but he was even unhappier with the government's response. They didn't want him to recuse himself, but they felt like they better mention this little point to me. I think maybe they thought I was going to find out. I don't know why. But in their response, saying, no, he's fine, this is nothing, they did a footnote. And the footnote's this long. And the footnote was, by the way, one of the attorneys on this case met with the judge after that luncheon, that speech, and asked him a question about their discovery obligations in my case, my client's case. And they asked him something that they would not disclose because it was a privileged conversation between them and the judge.
One of the government attorneys?
The government attorney.
One of the government attorneys met with the judge and asked them if they had to give
an ex parte conversation?
Yeah, an ex parte conversation with the judge. And they gave some hints in this page-long footnote that they asked him about the fact, about what kind of exculpatory evidence they had to provide in relation to expert discovery. And the judge told them they didn't have to. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking, well, I won't tell you what I was thinking. But I was, yeah. And so I filed my reply, and my reply was not nice. I tried to be very respectful in my motion because I didn't think the judge would recuse himself. I just wanted him to be aware that this was wrong. But now I knew he needed to recuse himself. And if he didn't, I was going to appeal it. And it turns out that this particular judge makes up a lot of the case law in the appellate court for why a judge should recuse themselves, because it seems he's been a little off-handed on a couple of occasions. And so I used to carry the order around with me, and I'm sorry, I was going to grab it today, because it's fun for me to read. I have it framed in my office. It's a one-page order, and it said, basically, I don't know what plaintiff petitioner's counsel is up to. She's wasting the time of the court. She's on a sideshow. But I recuse myself.
Wow.
It's like, yes. So I went from the very worst judge in my mind's eye to the second worst judge. And it's supposed to be a random selection, but I don't think it was. But it's okay. At least it's the second worst.
There are several other questions, so
I wanted to get back to the Al-Qaeda case, this 15-year-old Canadian kid, which is so outrageous. And I was encouraged that you suggested Obama people are still capable of embarrassment. And I'm wondering what evidence there is of that. Why you think they can't do anything but grin and bear it?
I think they're chicken shit. I think they're chicken shit. I think they're afraid. I think they're afraid of making mistakes, and they really weren't prepared for this, which is a shame. And they're being led by the nose by the Gates and the DOJ. It's the same people. The lawyers that I have dealt with under Bush are the same lawyers I'm dealing with now. And they were the ones that stalled these cases for years. And they just have not had the guts to clean it up and do the right thing. I don't know if they're afraid of the political fallout or if they just don't know what to do.
They're all DOJ.
Yeah.
And they were appointed by the Bush administration, is that what you're saying?
They were hired.
They were hired.
Most of them are not political appointees. They're staff attorneys, but they're all still there. The ones that staffed up the case under Bush are all still there. Obama didn't come in and fire anybody.
So what can be done?
We can all go to Canada. No, I don't know
what
can be done. All we can do is...
Could you say what you think the administration ought to do?
Yeah.
I think that they should, first of all, declassify these documents so that reporters can get in there and cover these cases. And I think that would make a big difference. I do think that there should be some firing of some of these lawyers that have been duplicitous and incompetent. And so
I agree. I mean, I think they should have cleared house in the DOJ.
Yeah. But otherwise, the procedure should just continue as it is.
Well, we've got the problem with the judges, too. But part of the problem with the judges is that they're taking the lead from the DOJ. So when the DOJ is fighting to keep things classified, fighting to keep men in Guantanamo, even though there's no evidence that they should be staying there, if we had a cleaner staff that was looking at this with a cleaner eye.
I also think on a more basic level that people should not be held unless they're going to be charged.
Okay, but let's say you're in the administration and you're in charge, whatever level of Attorney General's office. What would you do?
Well, I would declassify. I would go through these files and see who do we have real evidence against to prosecute in a federal criminal court, which would be a very small number of the people that are there. And the ones that are not there, I think you have to let them go. If you don't have the evidence, it happens every day in federal criminal courts or state criminal courts where there's a serious charge against somebody. He's a terrorist, he's a murderer. But the evidence doesn't support it, and a prosecutor has to make a decision that we can't proceed on this case. They shouldn't just hold somebody for 10 years if they don't have evidence against them. And right now, that's what they're doing. They know that they never have to show their cards, so they can just call them terrorists. Most of the people that were released, there's been some 400 or 500 people that were released from Gitmo. Most of it was not because of any judicial proceeding. It was because of back-channel negotiations with their country of origin. The Saudi Arabians got released because we had a good relationship with Saudi Arabia, and the Australians got released. It had nothing to do with who's guilty and who's not.